Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My guest today is a San Francisco Bay Area artist, writer, and naturalist. Obi Kaufman is an avid conservationist and intrepid explorer of California ecology. He was born in Hollywood in 1973, where his father was director of Griffith Observatory. He was raised in the East Bay and is based in Oakland. His first book, The California Field Atlas, was awarded the 2018 Book of the Year by the Northern California Independent Booksellers Association. His second book was The State of Water, Understanding California's Most Precious Resource. Andy Kaufman has now completed the first volume in a trilogy, along with The Coasts of California and The Deserts of California. We're going to be talking today about the first in this trilogy, The Forests of California. Obi Kaufman, welcome.
Hey, thank you so much, Nancy. I appreciate you talking with me today.
Well, you know, I opened your book, and the very first sentence was kind of a surprise. You say, this is a family album. Mm. And why do you call it that?
Mm. Well, that is a evolution from the first line of my first book, The California Field Atlas, which was that this is a love story. I've been hiking California my whole life. It has always been the subject of my art. It's always been the subject of my vocation. And it's always been the subject, quite frankly, of my deepest affection. I've always felt great kinship here. Like, this place is my home, more than my home. It's where my family lives. I identify with this place so completely. It's where I've decided to dig in and from where I take responsibility in all of my life.
Well, I like your first paragraph after that sentence, this is a family album. Would you read that first paragraph, Obi?
Certainly. I have explored the forests and they have explored me. In all my decades walking the California backcountry, I always find the same thing and I always feel the same way. I am of these forests and they are of me. In the bright and hot September sun of the High Sierra at over 12,000 feet, I've studied the foxtail pine and felt compelled to paint it again and again because I found it was the most beautiful thing I had ever seen. I've practiced the same thing with similar results in the gray and damp April mist of the Redwood Coast, dancing with my paint under the tallest trees on the planet. I've known the pleasure of walking for weeks along the southern ranges deep in the wilderness, where I use the water from trout-filled creeks to happily paint the infinite wildflowers in spring. I've had the honor to traverse California's northern volcanoes and paint antelope in their ancient range as the December snow began to fall. Under California's giving sky, alongside the ponderosa, the redwood, and the valley oak, I've gathered my ancient relatives to explore the past, present, and future ages of California's natural world. This is that story.
And this is Obi Kaufman reading from his newest California Field Atlas, The Forests of California. And you mentioned in there the painting, because when I first introduced you, I described you as an artist as well as a writer. And you have, well, describe the artwork that you have in this, which is quite extensive in this book, which I might add is over 600 pages, Obi, just for the listeners. Yeah, over 600 pages. And tell us about the artwork that you have in your book.
Yeah, thank you. Well, my understanding of the natural world comes from a synthesis of different disciplines, right? So I think most people, when you hear the word naturalist, you think science. You think one way of analysis, right? Which would be the other side of synthesis, as opposed to taking things apart. I bring things together. I was really inspired and have been over the decades by our greatest living naturalist here in America, Edward O. Wilson, E.O. Wilson, who described in a book that he called Consilience, the unity of all knowledge, when finally the humanities and the sciences will come together to tell a better story. And it is from that perspective that this book comes. So the painting is really one leg of a larger interdisciplinary inroad into understanding the ecological processes across the California floristic province and beyond, and how they have changed, how they have formed, and how, perhaps more important and even with more relevance, how they will continue to change and form in the immediate and long-term future.
Well, on this first page of your book, you refer to this book and you say, this communication, this story has within its mystery the solutions to unraveling some of the problems that are affecting every ecosystem, globally, regionally, and locally. And you use the word communication, but you add, I could just as well use the word connectivity. And what do you mean by that?
Well, I think what that gets to is a different way of looking at nature, one that I posit in the book about being what is of value in our society and how we value nature as a system. I like to philosophically think about the nature of value in regards to biodiversity and ecology, to transcend what maybe historically has been thought of, and indeed continues to be thought of in many circles, as the utilitarian value. What good is nature to us, mainly? When in fact, the intrinsic value, the other end of utilitarian value, the intrinsic value, the right of the river to flow clean, the right of biodiversity to exist at all, might in the end be the greatest value to our species, for one, for the ongoing sustainability and resiliency of human ecology in this most beautiful corner of the world, California.
Well, you entitled this introduction to your book, The Philosopher's Stone, and you even mentioned the word philosophy just now. Mm-hmm. And how does that play the role? What's the role that plays in understanding, your understanding?
Well, that gets to our oldest and best technology. Check this out. Okay, so it was about 100,000 years ago, at the beginning of what anthropologists might call the cognitive revolution, right? When humanity itself invented visual art, for one, invented storytelling, invented theater, invented fiction as a device of thinking about how the world works. No other species that we know of in the entire universe has done this. What we did 100,000 years ago, we invented this technology by which I can remove my animal behavior and hand it to you. Like, imagine me passing you a basketball. I can do that with this technology of storytelling. Often I just condense it to be story, with a capital S maybe. The technology of story. It is the reason why we have so successfully done what we have done since the cognitive revolution on through the urban revolution through to the technological industrial revolution. And now maybe even a fourth revolution is dawning, the ecological revolution. I am not here, Nancy, to convince anyone of anything. What I am here to do is to tell a better story. My aim is to contribute to the best story, the most important story I can imagine telling. And that story is the long past and future history of California's natural world. Not only is it the most important story I can think of to help to tell, but it has become, after so many years of focusing on it, the only story worth telling.
Well, in this introduction, you have an illustration that says A and B, A the story, B the understanding. And when I saw this illustration of Well, maybe you should tell us what this illustration is. A circle with a triangle in it, with a square, with a circle in that. What is that?
Well, I think that most people know the idea of the Philosopher's Stone as being the title of Harry Potter's first novel, which is the Philosopher's Stone, I guess, or is it the Sorcerer's Stone? I don't even know what it is. I don't even care. But that symbol there is the ancient Greek symbol of transformation from idea to concept to application in the field of human action. So I start with this for a very important reason, because we have to start from a common reference point. And now let me tell you a little story here, Nancy. When I went to school at UC Santa Barbara, I spent most of my time exploring the San Ynez Mountains and finding Chumash pictograph rock art sites. Now, the Chumash were a very successful culture that existed over many thousands of years prior to European contact, and they were really the painters of California. And there are still, to this day, hundreds of art sites across the San Ynez Mountains where you might like pull back a bush of manzanita and find this, 15-foot-long condor-like painting, exquisitely rendered, well, abstractly rendered, I should say, with maybe it has such non sequitur elements like a human leg or a sun mandala, or maybe something that looks kind of like a bug or a centipede or something like that. Really beautiful artwork. And now, as a human at that point, the late 20th century, and as an artist, I looked at this work and all of its narrative content has been lost to the seas of time, or most of it anyway. And what I did understand as a human and as an artist was that I was looking at the work of an artist who was operating with a very sophisticated set of cultural symbols from a context that I can absolutely relate to. This artist was participating with the story of their culture's relationship to the natural world in the same way that I am. Of course, we're using completely different cultural symbols, but the communication going on between the artist, the medium, and the audience, finally, whoever that artist was talking to, is the same process across humanity, across the whole field of history. So when you look through my book and you see the hundreds of, I'm the way that my, and indeed our brain structures perceptible two-dimensional rendered wildlife illustrations is very sort of particular. I think if I were to show this book to, say, that Chumash artist 500 years ago, they might be as bewildered. I'm certain they would be as bewildered looking at my artwork as I am looking at theirs. So, especially in these days, Nancy, of such incredible divisiveness in what truth is across all media, popular media, however it's broadcast, I wanted to start this book with that kind of like core human thinking. How do ideas translate to meaning? And I think that that is a good inroad to the larger discussion of where we're going and what our relationship is to the natural world.
We'll be back after a break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today is a writer, artist, and naturalist. His name is Obi Kaufman, and we're discussing his book, The Forests of California, which is a California field atlas. And I was referring to the geometrical design that you have in your introduction of the circle, and inside that a triangle, inside of that a square, another circle. But also on the cover of your book, there are geometrical shapes on the cover of your book. Would you describe that for the listener?
Oh, sure. Yes. Well, that gets to the, I guess you could call it the literary DNA of what the field atlas actually is. I made up this genre, Nancy. A field atlas doesn't exist. it's not like a field guide. A field guide will tell you what you're looking at. A field atlas describes how to look at what you're looking at in relation specifically to the systems where it exists. With, you know, sometimes when you bring up systems theory, especially in the days of the internet, you might be thinking that I'm talking about some sort of engineering problem. I assure you there's no math in my book. This is a synthesis of literary devices and artistic contrivances to describe this bigger interconnection of how a sense of geographic literacy, like how topography, how ecology is spread across this place to define the nature, the interconnected nature of that system. So the cover itself, I think, really describes a web, an architecture, something that is both resilient and perhaps vulnerable, which is a larger theme of books.
Well, there's another triangle on there. You have watercolors of some trees, and then you have a bird flying across the top.
Right. Yes, and that's an owl. It's a burrowing owl. That owl there is depicted in purple. See, and that goes that. That probably gets to some of the story that I'm telling too. You know, that it's not about my type of wildlife rendering is not scientific necessarily in objective recreation of what the owl feather actually is, but rather it might be a quick glimpse of the owl through the trees at twilight, when indeed it does appear to be purple.
Well, and it's not a shocking purple. It's a very subtle purple, and it wouldn't stand out as being, hey, what's that, a purple bird?
Right, but right. You get it. It's more immediate than that. It's more about how how about tricks of perception work. And I hope that even gets to a larger theme, a more subtle theme in the book, that all ecological truths are nuanced. This book isn't trying to convince you of anything. This book is simply a manual, a reference guide to geographic literacy in respect to the natural world of California. Now, it's not going to tell you like how to get places. If you want a road atlas, you can go get a road atlas. A field atlas, again, is just how these larger systems of perhaps earth, air, fire, and water all mix or coalesce rather in a very specific way that has yielded over the past several hundred thousand, even few million years, this portfolio of biodiversity that is world class in character.
At one point in your introduction, you say understanding systems and systems thinking is a good inroad to penetrate the deeper intentions behind this book. Systems thinking, as far as the scope of this book is concerned, is how entities relate to one another, either proportionately or allegorically. Mm-hmm. And that's another point you make. And in fact, later on you say, I aim to present California's arboreal ecosystems from a point of view that is not only promotes an ecological standpoint, but does so with moral intention. Mm-hmm. So your book is, as you've been describing, it's not a typical field guide. It's not that kind of book. And so you're saying that you make an argument that comes in the form of a narrative, as you said, mm-hmm. that exists within a complex system, but the conclusion is simple enough. The forests hold more intrinsic value than they do utilitarian value. And that's what makes me sad when I read back the history of what Europeans did when they came to this country. Mm. And that was their view. The forest, these natural resources are simply utilitarian. And you say no.
I say no, yes. Right. Well, it's true. I mean, my work acknowledges California as kind of a hyper object, if you will, a single contained living being whose ecosystems employ ancient complex tools of resiliency. I mean, California is very tough, but we are working very hard at mindlessly breaking those tools that California uses. And we have exposed this vulnerable heart to the state's ecological connectivity. But you know, I mean, Nancy, we are, this book is ultimately a work of hope, not despair. Let me reassure you that for every point of despair there is in this age of ecological anxiety, there is a point of hope. You know, I mean, as I was describing this world-class, this elite portfolio of biodiversity that California has, remarkably, it continues to have it. Now, although we've got, I mean, California is just a small sliver of the greater North American continent. In fact, it's about 4% of its total land area on the North American continent. But we have over 35 to 40% of all of its terrestrial species present right here living. And although all of our ecosystems, all of our natural habitat types are either threatened or endangered, every single one of them, although that is the case, we have a very low extinction rate. In fact, it's less than 1% here in 2020, which is a miracle given the very successfully imposed urban veneer that we have jacketed this place with in the past 170 years since the gold rush. Now, having that tiny extinction rate, realizing that it's all still here, means that there is still time. And if there is still time, there is still hope.
My guest is Obi Kaufman, a conservationist and explorer of California ecology. His latest book is The Forests of California. And Obi, you pose a question that I wish, I'm going to say Europeans in particular, but even today, that we had asked ourselves a long time ago, and that is, what do forests' ecosystems need to be healthy? We were always, it was utilitarian, we didn't look at what they needed to be healthy. What do forest ecosystems need to be healthy? And then, is there a correlation between the forest body and the human body? And that's a question I thought, gosh, I wish we had asked ourselves this question a long time ago. But you're asking us now to consider that.
That's for sure. Well, the question is ongoing, right? I mean, my goodness, I am sensitive to the fact that here I am on NPR Chico, and here we are, you there in the middle of two great questions that we ask ourselves every day as Californians. What do we do with the fire? What do we do with the water? Okay, so you've got Oroville down there, a keystone project in the California state water infrastructure. And we're moving on to the second anniversary of the disastrous, catastrophic campfire. It's amazing when I talk about, in particular, wildfire in California, how I describe when in fact, before Euro-American settlement, it was estimated that approximately 4 to 5 million acres a year burned under anthropogenic indigenous burn patterns. Now, last year, or in 2018, when the campfire hit, we only had a little bit over 1 million acres burned. Most of California is woefully fire deficient at this point. So when I say like 5 million acres burned per annum in pre-contact California, most of those fires, and many of them, of course, were sparked by lightning as well, but because of that regular fire regime, those fires were averaged on the scale of about 500 acres apiece, okay, as opposed to 150,000 acres. That was the campfire, right? These catastrophic. So we're policy towards the ecological health of our forests is a question that we'll always ask, that we'll always need to ask ourselves, we'll always need to evolve it, and we'll always need to engage it. So it's not something, it's not a bunch of questions that we perhaps failed to answer before, or perhaps answered in a different way than we're answering them now. But indeed, we are answering them now, going forward into the 21st and even 22nd century conservation policies. It will look much different than how it looks now.
My guest is Obi Kaufman, and his latest book, the first in a trilogy, The Forests of California. The next will be The Coasts of California and The Deserts of California, the third in this trilogy. And I mentioned when I introduced you that your father was director of Griffith Observatory. So you had, and your mother, a clinical psychologist, so you had some scientists as parents. But and you, when you mentioned that your father was an astrophysicist, and you say, Dad wrote textbooks and trained me to understand mathematics as the language of reality. I spent my life claiming that while reality is okay, poetry is the language of mind, and the mind is free to imagine all things as all things. So maybe in my introduction, I could have said, Obi Kaufman, poet.
Well, that I would have taken that as a compliment. Thank you. Yes, poetry is indeed a process, not a product. I keep working at it. Someday I'll get it right, or at least that's what I tell myself. But yeah, my dad wrote textbooks. He passed 20 years or so ago, and they still use his textbooks at universities across California. The subject of his vocation, his love, his metaphor was the universe itself, the whole cosmos. I have limited my focus to 100 million square acres of California as it's defined currently by its political boundaries. And yes, I find there enough content, as robust, deep, and beautiful as it is, that I could make 100 maps a day for the rest of my days and still not tell all the story that I wanted to tell. And so these books are big. You know, the joke is that I'm writing the Game of Thrones of California nature. So I've got the Forests of California, which is coming out now, and then I've got the Coasts of California, which will be out in the fall of 2021, and then the Deserts of California, which will be out in the fall of 2022. And together, those cover most of the grand topographic, physiographic regions of the state. And I would have made one probably called The Mountains of California, but there's some guy named John Muir who did that already.
Yes. Now, when you were talking about poetry, you say poetry works beyond words to be something more than verse. Although poetry is tied to language and to perception, its purpose is to transcend narrative. Poetry is the ability to witness and interpret interrelated moments of insight brought together by epiphany and serendipity. So here you are, a scientist in regarding nature, but then you have your poetic side, and you seem to be encouraging us to see the role that poetry can play.
Well, I'm a big believer in, getting back to that idea of hope, right? I'm a big believer in our ability to solve problems. I'm not going to bet against humanity yet. You know, I don't see that as even a question. I wonder about the nature of philosophy and how it moves, I believe, ultimately towards science. Science being more of a realm of truth, where art and the humanities might be more of a realm of meaning. I'll leave truth to the physical sciences. I get that. Now, meaning is something different. Meaning is absolutely enwrapped, fundamentally enwrapped, with our experience, evolutionarily endowed across the several million year history of our species. It has arisen from that. And it is unique to us in all of the cosmos. I mean, if the aliens were ever to come, they're not coming for our sciences. They will have figured all of that out already. The aliens are coming to learn about what makes us unique in the universe.
After a break, I'll be back with my guest, writer, artist, and naturalist Obi Kaufman, whose latest book is The Forests of California. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, writer, artist, and naturalist, Obi Kaufman, and he has illustrated a book entitled The Forest of California. And I mentioned that your book is not a field guide, it's a field atlas. So people might come to your book with the wrong expectations of what kind of book it is. So you actually give us some tips for enjoying your book. And I was hoping maybe you could tell us what these tips are. Mm-hmm. And you start by saying this is a field atlas. So what tips do you have for us to enjoy your presentation?
I'm a backpacker. Nancy, like, I like to get out into it. And if I don't, I begin to get stir crazy pretty quick. And when I go out into the field, I bring field guides. I like the little books that tell me what flowers I'm looking at and what birds I'm looking at. And this book is not that book. At over 2.5 pounds, the thing's nearly 700 pages. At over 2.5 pounds, don't attempt to go backpacking with this. There's more important things to carry, and that's precious weight. I know how precious weight can be for long days on
yes,
the trail.
I do too.
So this book is for when you come back, for the time between adventures, when you can dream about the larger systems of what you're actually witnessing out there in the field, how this is all tied together. You know, the core of this book is really about relationships. So in that way, it's more about ecology than it is about biology. The structure of the book, you can almost imagine as three concentric circles. In fact, I have this diagram that opens chapter 4, I believe. And it goes from the smallest inner circle, which is arboreal associations. We know that trees tend to gather together. We see the same kinds of trees together. The next larger concentric circle is habitat types. Now, how do all of those other life forms, all of the other biota, all of the flowers and the animals come together to form this much larger cell of relationships? Ultimately, then, to the largest concentric circle, which is the forest itself. I go through all 23 units of the U.S. Forest Service plots within California, which makes roughly half of the state's total land area. And I think that using those contemporary political boundaries is a nice contrivance to talk about which habitats are, for example, you've got the Plumas National Forest right next to you in Chico there. Like, what forest types are in Chico? So are in the Plumas National Forest. Like, how then do you see the patterns as they change across the spectrum of California and its forested areas? What I posit you begin to grow, what you begin to apprehend is something that I believe is the right, or rather the responsibility of any engaged citizen, which is this idea of geographic literacy. And I think that to know this stuff, is the kernel by which love grows. Getting back to the beginning of our conversation here, that this is a love story. I think people love, well, people protect what they love. How about that? People protect what
yes,
they love.
Yes, you make that point, yes.
But,
we protect and what we love.
We protect what we love, and we love what we know and what we understand. So what is there to protect? Let us begin with that, and then we can move on.
You, in your notes on enjoying your book, you make the point that your book is not to tell you what you're looking at or where you are. The book is not concerned with the what or where of things so much as it's concerned with the how of things. Mm-hmm. And you say it's a different kind of textbook. Mm-hmm. And what do you mean by that?
Well, I'm not going to... Well, I have to be very precise in the tone of my expertise, right? I am not a research scientist. I don't leave my audience like alone with facts and figures based on my analysis. My understanding of natural systems is based on synthesis, the bringing together of what might otherwise be disparate methodologies of knowledge. I create data-driven art. So that's work that encapsulates both of these concepts of truth and meaning, you know, but it is often compelled by my subjectivity. I never leave the perspective of me talking to you. I don't present this work as a manual to forestry, as a manual. This is not a manual of forestry. This is, well, let me put it this way. You know, most of these maps in the book, and there's hundreds of maps in the book, hand-painted maps of how the forests work around the state.
Hand-painted by you.
Right. Hand-painted by me. I'm the writer and the illustrator. You can find most of these maps on, you know, good old science-driven websites like USGS, USFS, you know, National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, these kinds of places, right? But they're usually kind of low res. They're usually 10 clicks in, you know, it's like, and those maps are not for you. I mean, they're used for research purposes. They're used for experts talking to one another. I took it on early as a burden and a responsibility, and indeed as an opportunity to break that out of there, you know, break that shell, release that information to the people. People need to know. I mean, one of the basic concepts of this book, one of the basic premises was that I was having a really hard time finding maps of the state's major watersheds, the water courses themselves as they flow through these national forests. How about we overlay that onto the national forests? What rivers actually flow where through what forests? It's a very simple cartographic problem, but largely impossible to find, especially on this thing called the internet that we're all glued to. So, you know, I've sort of reverse engineered all of this information from the internet down into this book form, which is, you know, the improved, I mean, its user interface is vastly improved over trying to dig for this stuff around on the net. So getting it all together in one place was definitely a prime mover in the creation of this book and continues to be.
My guest is Obi Kaufman, and his latest book, The Forests of California, is the first in a trilogy to be followed by The Coasts of California and The Deserts of California. Now, some people might pick up a book like this, they're browsing, and they say, The Forests of California. Well, I'm looking for a tourist guide. And you say, no, that's not what this is.
Well, that being said, I do think that it is the ultimate souvenir. Whether or not you're visiting California or you just want to be more from this place. Now, it's not a tourist guide because I'm not going to tell you the top 10 waterfalls to go see, you know, in Shasta County or whatever. You know, that's not the point of this. The point of this is to figure out how the machine works, where it came from, where it's going, and how we can all get there together. How we can finally stop having the conversation. I mean, my goodness, if you listen to too much social media, it feels like we're not even going to make it till next Tuesday. How do we change that conversation? How do we put down all of this divisive rhetoric from whatever to whatever? We're just Californians figuring this place out. And what that means, what it means to be a Californian in the 22nd century. How about that question? In the next 15 years, we're going to get another several million people here. People love to come to California. We have to know what we need to protect. We have to defend the native processes, ecological functioning of this place. And because we don't fully understand how the architecture may or may not fall apart, it is dire for us to keep every piece that is on the board still on the board. So how do we keep it so?
Well, I'd like to ask you about the opening of your first chapter, The Field Atlas. Mm-hmm. And you tell the reader, I'm going to start with a story. And what's that story, Obi?
Well, it's the story of a bit of the West Coast of North America that is approximately the same age as our species itself. I love
you
to
say it's you have a recurring dream.
Oh, that dream. Oh, yeah, that dream. I do like that dream.
Yeah, I have a recurring dream.
Well, it kind of touches on what I was talking about, but I would love to walk you through that. And that dream is about maybe California a couple hundred years ago, or maybe it takes place in California a couple hundred years from now. I'm not sure which, but it's walking on a riverbank, and the river is 30 miles wide, so it must be the Sacramento River, and it must be May. And I'm walking up this thing, and I see the surface is glinting nickel as salmon stacked up like cordwood or people-sized salmon are pushing their way back up to their headwaters to claim their immortal birthright. And as I'm walking, I turn and walk up the the foothills of the Sierra up a water course that is terraced by beaver dam after beaver dam, so dense it's two or three lodges per mile, bastions, sanctions, and factories for biodiversity, perfect for salmon to skip up like a staircase. And up these riparian forests, the ground itself is tilled by grizzly bear claw, who are feasting on this enormous bounty of anadromous fish. And in the little troughs that the grizzly bears have routed, up springs a million species of flowers. I exaggerate there. But it does seem that for every flower, there is a bee species that has been evolutionarily designed to pollinate said flower. And then the beaver and the salmon together working to make actually a healthy forest ecosystem. Can you imagine all of those salmon finally making it to the headwaters at the top of the mountain and then depositing their mortal bodies, hundreds of thousands of metric tons of calcium, phosphorus, and nitrogen to feed the entire forest body from there. That is a thought, a dream that gets me out of bed in the morning to go do my work and tucks me into that same bed at night when the day is done.
Well, you include a lot of information in your book, and including California's fault lines. And what should we know about California's fault lines?
Well, California right now is a snapshot. It was never like this, and it won't be like this again. If you can imagine California 5 million years from now, when the peninsula of Baja becomes the island of Baja, when Los Angeles becomes a suburb of San Francisco. And we know this from basic tectonic theory. We know pretty much exactly what the coastline of California will look like in 5 million years. Will even placental mammals be the order of the day? Impossible to say at this point. But long after what they call the sixth mass extinction of Earth has passed and Earth is rebounding again, working on even conceiving of what a seventh mass extinction might look like, the biodiversity we find on the island of Baja will be replete with a full complement of species that we could never imagine or even wonder as to how or what that habitat might look like and function as. And that nature's infinite ability to reimagine itself is not a gloomy thought at all to me. In fact, I think that there is so much beauty, so much inspiration in the creative engine that is California's natural world, that extends from antiquity to the unimaginable future, in such a way that how could we not stand in wonder and awe of this most beautiful California?
Well, thank you for writing this book. Let me remind people that this book we've been talking about is the first in a trilogy. Obi Kaufman is an artist, writer, naturalist, and his previous book, A California Field Atlas, his newest book, also A California Field Atlas, is The Forests of California. Thank you again.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I had a great time.
And now a poem by local poet Amy Anton Giovanni.
This is Names of Flowers for Ruth Lee Patterson, who was my grandmother and who taught me the names of the flowers I know. Names of Flowers. Mexican sage stutters the hillside, and honeysuckle climbs the rail to my door. Almost too sweet to bear, star jasmine, your delphinium eyes, the distance you keep. Like a monarch, butterflies away, then alights in the feathered dill, green asparagus tips. I think of you picking chamomile along this path, and when two hummingbirds helix up from the giant echeveria, neither chases the other away. One late afternoon, I sat in the Buddha grove and waited, looked out over the gray expanse. No whales today, hoping you'd come. Two otters or tender-headed kelp, I couldn't tell which they were, close friends in floating, bellies to the blue sky above us all. Was that your smile in the rows of marigolds lining a field of organic kale? Alstroemeria or Peruvian lily and nasturtium cascading down the side of the cliff. Impossibly sad not to feel you here. I would have shown you the mandala made of driftwood and river stones, smooth as a girl's wrist. Touch this, sweet pea, you said, from beyond the beyond. May you grow taller regardless of fear. May you stand like rocks rising from the sea, solid, still, despite centuries of fracturing. May you rise like dolphins that crest and dive in smooth commas and let the E minor chord caught in your throat reverberate like chimes hanging from the cypress at the water's edge. Here is a black crow feather. Lift it skyward, toss it into the wind. You know what to do with a bit of forever. Amy Antongiovanni.
Thank you, Amy. And I'd also like to thank my first guest, the author of The Forests of California, Obi Kaufman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.